Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So today we are reading from Canto 5, Chapter 13, the final verse, that is Text 26. The Sanskrit goes, Yahava Iva Bahuvada Mahabhagavata Dvadbhinta Parol Krishna Sena. Vakastu Jiva Loka Bhavtava. Sahihaya Man Isya Kalpita Visaya. Nanjai Sadvi Upanaloka. Samini Gama Atatad Ivatad. Drovagma Samit Anu Kipena. Yudhisyatamiti. Some of you may not believe this, but I'm not a great Sanskrit scholar. Translation. King Parikshit then told Sukadeva Goswami, My dear Lord, O great devotee sage, you are omniscient. You have very nicely described the position of the conditioned soul, who is compared to a merchant in the forest. From these instructions, intelligent man can understand that the senses of a person in the bodily conception are like rogues and thieves in that forest, and that one's wife and children are like jackals and other ferocious animals. However, it is not very easy for the unintelligent to understand the purport of this story because it is difficult to extricate the exact meaning from the allegory. I therefore request your holiness to give the direct meaning. So this again, is the final verse, the final text of chapter 13, Yahuvinda's conversation with Jataparata, and it is almost totally concerned with the same theme about the material forest of sense gratification, how the material world is really a hellish place. There's so many problems and there are so many difficulties concerned with it. There's a teaching that the wise person will learn from hearing. So if somebody hears good advice from the Srimad Bhagavatam, they can save themselves a great deal of trouble and go on a very enlightened path. But certain other people, they're very skeptical and they don't, I don't believe it, or I'm going to try this anyway, like that. And so instead of learning the easy way, then they learn the hard way from experience. I know that having lived a material life for many, many years, I have a realistic idea of what it is and what it isn't. And the descriptions in the Srimad Bhagavatam are so exact, so precise. You're striving so hard for sense gratification, and then when you're successful, it only lasts for a few moments, and then you have all the headaches and all of the heartaches. I know I lived there in New York City, and I became aware that there were many visitors from India who came to the United States. They didn't especially come as tourists. They wanted to go to America and live the American way of life. America, the richest country in the world, the most powerful. So they wanted to be a part of that. However, after they'd been there for a year or two, they quit and go home. They go back to India, because the kind of bliss and pleasure and satisfaction they were trying for, it just was not there. I've had, through the years, many years of experience, a range of contacts and associations which covers a huge spectrum of human activity. I had some contacts with the mafia. Two of my closest friends, they were Italian Americans, and they maintained their mafia connection. They came from Sicily. One was a United States federal judge, his son had at one point been Attorney General, a very high position in the administration, to be the chief legal counsel for the government, like that. And unfortunately, it didn't bring them happiness at all. There was prestige. I don't know if you people here are familiar with the name, the Waldorf Astoria. That's kind of a super elite hotel in New York City. And the judge's dinner, he used to have once a year. And it cost, to attend, $100 a plate at that time. In other words, if you're going to sit down at the judge's dinner, it cost you $100 a plate. Now the price had gone up to $1,000 U.S. dollars a plate to have dinner. So it was pretty exclusive. And I remember there were three presidents of the United States I got to meet personally. There was President Eisenhower, President Kennedy, President Johnson. I got to meet them personally. There was a special room for the guests. Our people were very snobbish, and we look out at the Waldorf Astoria, the huge ballroom, dining room there, and like my friend, he pointed out to me, he said, "Oh, that's all the rubbish. Those people, they're only, you know, they're $100 plate people." The real exclusive place was in the private room, where they had a private party for the honored guests, and that's where you got to meet the President of the United States and stuff like that. So I cultivated, because that's the American way of life. You want to be a social climber, or more important. I did have contacts and maintain to this day, on the other end of the spectrum, as I mentioned, the mafia. And I've got a couple contacts in with them. One is a person who's born into a mafia family, but this person has nothing to do with those kind of activities. The person has a job in the government, living a squeaky clean life. But still, the contacts are there. And then another mafia contact that I had, and this came as quite an amazing thing, but absolutely true story. There's one very inner family, inner, one of the top mafia people, in his private home where he lived, he had piles, literally piles of money, stacks of $100 bills, U.S. $100, and they were all the way up, right there, all the way around the rooms, like that. And more coming in all the time, more money coming in all the time. His main problem was to try to figure out what to do with it. He didn't have to pay any taxes, of course, it was all gained illegally, like that. And there were other kinds of success that I've had personal contact with. When things were going upscale for me, I had an apartment in New York on Fifth Avenue, very, very exclusive. And in the building next to mine, probably, again, you'll recognize his name, the building next to mine, there was living Nelson Rockefeller. So it was really exclusive. I could remember, I would look out my front window in the morning onto Fifth Avenue, and there was Rockefeller's building next to mine, and there would be a long line of Rolls Royces, all with chauffeurs, waiting to pick up. I get, you know, over here what is a Rolls Royce? It's a very upscale, expensive kind of a car, automobile, like that. So, people are striving for this material success. This building where Nelson Rockefeller lived, on Fifth Avenue, the one next to mine, Richard Nixon, who was the president of the United States, he wanted to get and live in that building, have an apartment there. But they didn't want him. He's only a politician. I mean, even they didn't want nouveau riche, newly rich people. They wanted old money, aristocrats, aristocracy like that. And he was just, you know, a politician. Finally, after a whole big commotion, they finally let him in to the building, but he had to use a side entrance. He couldn't go into Fifth Avenue, the exclusive entrance like that. So they compromised and let the president go. And then the elitism that people are striving for, you know, society, to be the social climber, the American way of life, to be wealthy and deal with the elite, and to avoid the nouveau riche, the new money people. You go with the old money people. And occasionally I would get invited to a very exclusive party, super elite. And I remember, you talk about snobbery. A friend of mine came over to me and he pointed to this guest, who, you know, a visitor at this elite party, and he was saying, oh, he's terrible, that person. Oh. I said, well, what did he do? He said, he tried to talk to me. That's the kind of snobbery that the social climbers are involved in. So, and one last kind of, just a little sample of the world of the elite and the super elite. I remember I got an invitation to a super elite party, extra, and the building was very exclusive, and the apartment was very high class, 14-foot ceilings. Maybe that doesn't mean too much there, but in Manhattan, 14-foot ceilings really counted for something. And I always remember, even down to this day, to this moment, one thing that really impressed me very much the host of this elite party in this elite place. He was standing and leaning up against a pillar like that, watching the guests come in. And he had a look of total boredom. It was just like, oh my God, who's this person, who's that? He didn't want to be bothered. So the point of all this is that in the material world, this attempt to climb, to be exclusive, to be elite, sometimes it's successful. But even when it is successful, it's not successful, because it doesn't bring the happiness that that people are striving for. And I, as I say, I've had friends, they've had some really major successes. I had one friend, he worked for a steamship company, major, and they used to transport cargo from Europe to the U.S. And he would help rent the cargo ship and take care of the merchandise. One load would cost about $6 million, just for one shipment like that. And he used to do that. He worked for the company for 2 years. And then he did what any New Yorker would do. I mean, if you're not from New York, you wouldn't know. But if you are, I don't have to tell you. Naturally, he left the company he worked with for 2 years, the cargo company. He started his own cargo company in competition, and he stole as many clients, the former clients, from his old boss and brought them to his own company. You know, that's New York City. That's the material way of life. And it has its high moments when you might be successful with one of these tactics. But in the long run, it doesn't bring lasting happiness. It's just very, very temporary, very, very temporary, very fleeting. So, what is the solution? What is the solution? You go out there in the material world, you try your best, and say, I've met people, they were born, sometimes they were born very wealthy, sometimes they worked for it and earned their own money, and everything in between. Sometimes they would inherit the money. One very wise person, I lived in Radhakund for some years, and I remember there was a Babaji there who had been a businessman. And he had a wise saying, which has stuck in my mind for all these years, talking about money. He said, there's a lot of trouble it takes to earn money. There's a lot of care it takes to preserve it, so you don't, you know, lose it. You don't get cheated. You have to work to preserve your money, keep it safe. And there's a lot of trouble to spend it wisely. Of course, you can spend it in many different foolish ways. So we said the best thing is not to have anything to do with money like that. And so that is not very, very far from Vaishnava teaching. Of course, it should be remembered that, as Prabhupada taught, that anything in the material world, with one exception, can be used in the service of the Lord. The one exception that cannot be dovetailed in any way is envy. And so we should try, if Lord forbid, we feel something like that creeping in, we should not let it dwell in our heart, in our mind. We should drive it away. As quickly as possible, because it's poison. One of the ways of helping to protect about that is to recognize that ultimately, on a spiritual sense, we're all brothers. We have the same Father. Krishna is the father to all of us. So everybody is our brother. And we should respect our brothers and try to help them and not disparage them. Of course, my own two brothers maybe are an exception. So if anybody wants my two brothers, I'll give them away for free. But you have to keep them. I'm just joking. They're actually very, very nice. But all of these materials in the these problems of the material world, what is ultimately the best way? You can't fight something with nothing. That's a teaching and comes from the high levels of the political world. If you have a candidate who people don't really like him very much, but he's around for years, he's well known, and you want to defeat him, you can't bring in a nobody. You have to bring somebody that's well known and well established to run against him. So you can't beat somebody with nobody. So you can't beat Maya. You can't beat all of these temporarily attractive elements unless you have something that's more attractive. If you have something more attractive, then people will dump that other stuff and they won't look back. They'll leave it all behind them. And when it comes to the bottom line, there is nothing more powerful and nothing which can become more attractive than the chanting of the holy name. The holy name is the prayer, been called the prayer of the beginning, the middle, and the end. Because if a person's beginning their spiritual life, a good way to begin, oh Prabhu, here's Japa Mala, chant one round. It begins with the chanting of the holy name. And if a person really gets more attracted into it, they start chanting more and more and more. And by that chanting, they make real progress. If a person's in it, he wants to progress quickly. There's many ways of bona fide ways of making spiritual progress. Deity worship is one, for example. But the most single, most powerful is the practice of the holy name. And so if you want to progress, do more chanting. And it's called the prayer of the beginning, the middle, and also, as you said, of the end. And that means when we've come and advanced from brahmachari life and as a beginner up to a higher level, the holy name is so attractive that it's not a chore. It's not, oh, I've got to do my 16 rounds. Oh my goodness, you know. It's 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Somebody says, well, you want to take I can't probably, I've got to finish my rounds. I've got to finish my round. If we take the holy name seriously, if we believe the Shastra, if we believe the gurus, if we believe the sadhus, the holy name is the supreme path to higher spirituality. And the fact of the matter is, we can be chanting always, at every moment. But before we elaborate too much on that, there's some practical wisdom, practical spirituality, if somebody gets serious about the holy name. One fact, I've talked to a couple of devotees who have experienced that. They said, yeah, that's true. And the fact is that if you wake up early, like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, the rounds come quickly and easily. If you want to get into some serious numbers, get up early in the morning. The later in the day, the slower they go. Now, we should never be carried away with the numbers game, just trying to get big numbers, because the quality of the chanting is just as important, more important than the quantity. So if somebody said, okay, I'm going to chant 64, like that, you know, just to get the big numbers, they're not doing themselves a big service at all, actually. One of the secrets of success, as I mentioned, is to get up early, because the rounds, they come quickly and easily. And the other secret of success is no secret, because we've been told over and over and over again through the years. But how many of us follow? Humbler than the straw in the street. Humbler than the straw in the street. We can allow everybody to walk over us and not complain. Offer all respects to others and expect none in return. If we're in this mood, then we can always chant the holy name. I found this, even if you get up early, 2 or 3 in the morning, there'll be a time when your chanting may slow down. And you're wondering, it's slower than normal. It isn't even your normal chanting speed. And you're wondering, what the heck? Look, I got up this early, I'm trying to chant, and I can't get any rounds done. When that moment comes, if it comes, and it could come to anybody, the solution is simple. Pranam. Just do a full prostration. Humble yourself on the floor. Spread out completely. And there's a teaching that humility, of all spiritual gifts, is the most important, the greatest. Because if you have the gift of humility, all of the others come in its wake, follow after it. The problem is, humility is such a precious gift that we can't do it ourselves. It's a gift from Krishna. True humility comes from the Lord. But my own perspective is, fake it till you make it. And then pretend to be humble, go through the externals, chant the holy name, and then Krishna may be motivated to touch, send the real deal along like that. Now, as I mentioned, most of us have this idea of 16 rounds. And they say, well, Prabhupada wants us to do a minimum of 16 rounds. But actually, that's not what Prabhupada said at all. That's not what he taught, and that's not what he meant. What he said was, I want my disciples, I want my students, I want my devotees to always chant the holy name. But since they can't do that, I give them a minimum of 16 rounds, like that. So we shouldn't have as our ultimate goal, it's not wrong to do 16 rounds, and it's a good way to start, but our ultimate goal should be what Prabhupada is talking, to always chant the holy name. Now, one wonders, how is it possible? I've got service to do. How am I going to be chanting rounds like that? But the truth of the matter is, if you're serious about the holy name, it's never a question of either or. Either I do my service, or I chant the holy name. No. A person who's serious can chant within the mind, can chant within the heart, and he can chant always. So while doing service, he can also be chanting the holy name. And in this way, the holy name can be constant. I want to share a personal experience. Maybe I shouldn't share it. It's quite personal. And if I'm making a mistake in sharing it, all right. But if even one person can benefit from it, it'll be worthwhile. And it has to do with the fact that when we get serious about chanting, it, after a while, is not a chore. It's a bliss. The bliss of the holy name starts to kick in. And instead of saying, oh my heaven, I've got to finish my rounds, you get not only attracted, you get addicted to the holy name. You don't want to stop. You can't stop like that. The name goes on at every moment. And I remember, and I try to practice what I preach. I'm a big hypocrite and big phony about so many things, but occasionally I get out of character and I try to practice what I preach. But with the name, I remember that I was walking down the main street in the middle of the day. It wasn't a secluded place. It wasn't at sunrise, the Brahmamurti. It wasn't at sunset, where a nice, mellow place for meditation. It was high noon on a busy street. The horns are honking. Traffic is going along. What a lot of commotion. You couldn't think of a worse place to want to do meditation. But I try to practice what I preach. Now I'm chanting the holy name. I'm chanting the holy name. And then I'm going like this, just remembering. All of a sudden, I got hit in the head, my whole head. It was filled with bliss. There was an illumination, a bright light that completely filled my head, and total bliss. And then, I was shocked walking down the main street at noon, and there is this bliss. And then the bliss went down through my body, all the way down to my feet, to the tips of my toes. I was filled with bliss, and I couldn't stand up. I was on my knees on the sidewalk. I was weighed down by bliss, like that. So this is like just one little personal experience coming from the practice of the holy name. There's another symptom which is available there and coming from Shastra. And again, this will come to people who are serious about the holy name. And that is, they talk about tears coming from the eyes. Tears coming from your eyes. Now, most sadhus, I've been in different parts of the world where different sadhus, and a lot of the seniors, they're well aware that one of the symptoms of advancement in chanting is that tears come from your eye. So this, what did he do? He wanted to show off. He wanted to the prestige. And he got some onion, and he took pieces of onion and he put it up into his nostril. So tears would come down his eyes, and then he could say, oh, see, I'm a great sadhu, like that. So one of the little things he was not aware of is the way the human eye is constructed. Tears can come from two places. They can come from inside the eye, here. And maybe when you could remember when you were a little baby or a little child, and mommy hollers at you or something like that, and you start crying, oh, mommy, mommy. And the tears come down from here. And the tears are hot and salty. But the tears of bliss, the tears of joy, that come from the chanting of the holy name, they come from the outer part of the eye. And they are cool. And they are sweet. And dear again, when you get serious about the holy name, you're just overtaken. You're overtaken with bliss. I'm told one of the symptoms of advancement is your hair stands on end. If I ever had any hair, maybe that might happen. But I'm not counting on this, that particular symptom for myself. Yeah. The idea of constantly chanting, we should have that as a goal, and remembering that it's bona fide. Ideally, it's better to chant out loud. There is some different sects of sadhus that have different teachings, but we follow Prabhupada. But in some of these other sects, they say it's better to chant silently within. But no, when we can't do chanting out loud, it's perfectly okay. But it's better to chant out loud, because then we're not chanting just for ourselves. The sound goes and it benefits not only any person there, but plants, insects, birds, animals, anything within the range of our hearing can be benefited by chanting out loud. There's one really essential point that, if I didn't say anything else, I would want to make this point, because people in spiritual life, it's something they should be aware of. I have to say, my stay in this temple has been very wonderful. The temple building itself is great, but even greater are the devotees that live here. They are sublime. They are really very, very advanced. So they may, none of them have this problem, but to be aware that the single greatest cause for downfall of a devotee is Vaishnava aparadha. And I've seen heartbreak. I've seen devotees that were so pure and so elevated, so intelligent. They knew the Shastras. They could quote to you the whole Bhagavad Gita. They had memorized it. They could quote to you passages after passage and so many other things. And still, they did a nosedive. And they went out into Maya, into the material world. And the explanation is almost always the same. What is the problem? Vaishnava aparadha. The Shastras, the scriptures explain that even if you're on the level of Lord Shiva, such a wonderful, sublime personality, but if you're on the level of Lord Shiva and you commit Vaishnava aparadha, you will go down. Vaishnava. You go down. And practical applications. If somebody, if you're in the, first of all, for ourselves, never ever speak bad about any devotee. And it's always good, I know from my own personal life experience in the material world, I took a great joy in bad-mouthing people. I loved to insult people. And I was a very expert fault finder. And I would always have something nasty, some rotten remark. I remember a friend of mine, legal secretary, was saying, "Oh, my mother, I'm so lucky. I have a wonderful mother. And my father, he's absolutely marvelous." And my smart aleck remark was, "Oh, that's nice, but when are they going to get married?" So that was my way of getting through things. But after spiritual life, I try to do exactly the opposite. Instead of trying to find faults, I always try to look for the good in people. And I find just by changing that, you feel happier inside. You're thinking good about everybody that comes along. Can I pause here and ask, are there any questions or comments? Does somebody have a comment to make? That bell is a reminder that we've just timed this pretty well. 9 o'clock, the class is supposed to end, and I think I should get a lot of praise for coming so close like that. Thank you for your patience and listening. Oh, I'm sorry, excuse me.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji. Thank you for a very nice class. So my question is that we are hearing every day this class, Bhagavatam class, but still we are doing Vaishnava Aparadha. What is the main cause behind it?
Well, I would say the main cause is you didn't listen carefully enough. because you would see the penalties of Vaishnava aparadha are terrible. They're awesome. You can lose your, and you will do, not maybe. If you commit Vaishnava aparadha, you will lose your entire spiritual life. You won't be a devotee anymore. It might take a couple months or something like that. And it might be mentioned too, it's important to keep in mind that if you listen to Vaishnava aparadha, you hear it or you speak it, it's both equally bad. If you hear a devotee bad mouthing another devotee, speaking bad, one of two things. You should defend the devotee who's being spoken badly of. You should say, no, he's a good devotee, he's been in the movement for 15 years, and he keeps all the standards very high. You can defend him on the one hand. And the other possibility is just walk away, don't listen to it anymore. And also to stay away from that kind of a person, avoid that kind of a person. Other questions? Srila Prabhupada ki jai.